I'm Chris Reback. This is BCRF Conversations, our series focusing on scientists, thinkers, and leaders who drive the insights and breakthroughs of breast cancer research. The list of symptoms associated with cancers of all kinds is, of course, extraordinarily long. Particularly among breast cancer survivors, these can include fatigue, hot flashes, and cognitive changes related to chemotherapy, nausea and vomiting, and sexual health, just to name a few. And of those, while sexual health and functioning have been reported in over 50% of women diagnosed with breast or gynecologic cancer, in most cases, these issues are not a part of standard cancer care, which is where the research comes in. How can various physical symptoms, fatigue, body image, and partner issues predict overall sexual health among cancer survivors? And what interventions from clinical to medications to behavioral show the most promise? Dr. Deborah Barton is the Mary Lou Willard French Professor of Nursing at the University of Michigan School of Nursing. She has spent her career looking at symptom management from multiple perspectives and finding ways to use more than one intervention to reduce symptoms with minimal to no side effects. She's also been a BCRF grantee since 2008. Dr. Barton, thanks for joining me. This range of symptoms for people undergoing cancer treatments or even survivors is so unbelievably long for many folks, both on the, you know, science and research side, but also, you know, on the patient side and on the, you know, just among folks who, you know, are dealing with the disease. I'm sure it can become a bit overwhelming. You focus on oncology symptom management. As you think about that range of symptoms and as you've thought about it over your career, how do you begin framing that and considering where to act?
So that's a very good, comprehensive question. And I think there are as many people who are interested in symptom management and survivorship care, you would probably get different answers from every single person because there are lots of places one could start. And for me, the decision has been based on where it is the literature, the evidence in terms of what the most common distressing symptoms are. And then coupled with that is where is there the biggest gap in terms of things to do and as well as areas that are not easily integrated into cancer care. So for me, that meant fatigue in particular, and sexual health. As you alluded to in the introduction, fatigue is one of those symptoms that actually crosses all types of cancer and treatment and can actually last. There's data in breast cancer survivors that fatigue can exist long after treatment is over. And the question becomes, why is that? Why doesn't the body go back to kind of its pre-diagnosis normal? And that's part of what I'm trying to understand with fatigue research. And then the other area is sexual health. And fatigue certainly contributes to that. If you're, I mean, anybody who's had a child can remember what that sleep-deprived time in their life was and how perhaps little interest they had in sexuality, for example. It's not too dissimilar in cancer survivors going through all the stress of treatment and having sleep disturbed and dealing with a lot of different symptoms. You don't exactly feel like you're best self. And so helping women in particular, which is what my research is who my research is with, help get back to as much of their normal as possible to feel like their whole, well, integrated self is really what I want to help people do. And once we figure out what things help with that, then the next step, of course, is to do the kind of research where we can identify very easily adaptive processes to actually put that as part of care so that it's not a burden, so that it's not a whole bunch of extra time, but so that people, providers, can be very well versed on how to help women address those very important issues from the very beginning throughout their entire treatment course and afterwards, so that they can move through the cancer trajectory very smoothly back into their full lives and have their full quality of life.
So this question of quality of life, as I've talked to various scientists and researchers, obviously that is such a key and personal part of cancer care, and the definition of quality of life, obviously can range. On some level, on the one hand, obviously we know there are measurements of quality of life that get taken, but at the same time, it can often come down to just a personal sense. I'm struck by the fact that as you approach that and on the sexual health portion and the sense of somebody feeling as their best selves, which I can only imagine is incredibly difficult to do, to say the least. It sounds like you actually start working with women during the treatment, which that surprises me, or surprised me, because I would think that during the treatment, anyone would feel much, much less than their best self. So is that part of the treatment? Is that about, a future mindset? Is that about getting folks thinking and envisioning life, as it, going on in the future, not getting caught up in the current, status or stage that they're at? Or are there actually actionable things that folks can do, the women can do or desire to, to do around treatment, even while they're undergoing, active, cancer treatments?
So that's a very important point, and it's something that is very common, your surprise at starting during treatment. A lot of people think that. A lot of people think, during treatment, that's when people are focused on, getting their cancer treatment and fighting their disease, and they're not interested in other things. Yes, the symptoms that are tightly linked to chemotherapy, like nausea and vomiting, yes, we're going to address, but all those other things can wait, and they're not as important at that point. But what I believe and what the actual data has shown is that starting earlier to set the context and give people preparatory information so that they know what kinds of things people have experienced, what's possible, what they might experience, how they might feel, and how that might change over time is really important, because people can assume, women can assume, oh man, I feel like this. I bet I'm the only one in the whole world that's ever felt this way. And I wonder if I'm taking this harder than everybody else, or if this is, something unusual. And sometimes they never ask those questions. And so I think it's really important to let women know what the range of potential symptoms and changes might be, and to remind them that that it is possible to try and keep some kind of normalcy throughout their treatment, so that it's not so much of a change to get back to their normal life after treatment. So let me give you a very concrete example.
Yeah, please.
We're working with women on self-image, and we are doing this relaxation imagery hypnotic intervention to help women relax and see themselves as whole and well and strong. And as part of that intervention, we have women choose a behavior that, this is at the end of the intervention, choose a behavior that sort of expresses who they are, and to integrate that into their lives. And we are doing the study with women who have completed treatment at least 6 to 12 months previously. So these are people who are done with treatment. And to my surprise, it's the whole study is to improve sexual health. So I sort of assumed that women were going to choose, you know, romantic getaway weekends to plan or buying a new outfit or something like that.
Yeah.
But they're not. Mm. What they are choosing to do for the most part is reconnecting with a hobby that they did before cancer treatment that they had totally kind of let go of, forgot about. So, and many of those hobbies are related to arts and crafts that, you know, like you know what? I used to paint. Boy, I haven't painted for 2 years. I'm going to get my easels out and paint again. And that has been so, and you know, lots of examples similar to that. And that has been so, such an aha moment for me that if we could upfront, you know, tell women not to forget about those things that are part of who they are and how they express themselves, you know, they may not be able to do it to the extent because there are a lot of things you have to fit in during treatment. I'm not naive about that. But if even if they could, like, save a little piece of time for themselves to do something that expresses who they are, it will, I believe, that it will help the coping and the transition throughout the treatment.
You know, it's almost I'm sure it is, it's a combination. What I'm hearing is really this combination of what I can only assume is a range of sciences, is the medical component, obviously, in a physiological and physical aspect. But so much of what you're discussing, to me, you know, as a layperson, is the psychological, the emotional, and really that, you know, that phrase that you used earlier in the conversation of, you know, being one's best self. And it's a fascinating insight that one of the things, and you hear this, right? You hear people who are going through or have gone through cancer, and you hear the stories of how they learned about themselves, and you hear about that journey. And it's sounding like, you know, some of the work that you're doing, where if one can reconnect, you know, maybe with a lost trade or a lost passion that you know, a woman had or a person had, you know, once upon a time, that's a fascinating and, again, you know, to me, unexpected part of a cancer treatment, and a very positive one. Is that kind of what has drawn you to this aspect, both kind of the surprises and the learnings, but also it's a very positive aspect of what can, you know, obviously often be such a challenging and difficult time.
Yes, I think that you summarized that very well. And I think one of the things that I am very passionate about is I believe very strongly in the power of the mind, and there is a connection. You know, I remember a long time ago listening to somebody talk about just the fact that when you take a very deep breath in, hold it for a couple seconds and let it out, it changes all of your brain chemistry. And we have a huge resource in our brain, in our mind. And what I explain to patients is that, you know, we don't wake up in the morning saying, you know, I'm going to be just really crabby today and going to be in a down mood. We don't make that decision consciously. Something happens in our environment that triggers some negative cognitions that we have had and experienced in the past that kind of sets our mood off, and then we have it. If we could realize what those were and then change them, we could actually change our days. And so one of the things that I feel very strongly about is that we need to do research to show what these behavioral and cognitive interventions do physiologically. Because I personally would posit that they are as strong or stronger as any drug we could take. and that we just have to we have to do the research to show what the what physiology we impact when we do certain things.
It's a very compelling point. I mean, who among the, you know, who wakes up and says, you know what, I'm going to be my worst self today. You know, I'm not going to go for my best. Right? So yeah, it's a compelling point. And it connects me as well to something that you said earlier in this conversation as well that struck me, which is that you communicate, I forget your exact phrasing, but your point was that you communicate not only with, patients, but also with providers. And that, what is that audience like? How receptive is the provider audience, do you find, to your messages, to your research? This is probably an outdated view, but I could imagine, you know, doctors and scientists and folks who may be very steeped in the medical or the physical or the physiological component, is connecting your message with them challenging, or do you find great reception to it and in fact they, you know, are open and grateful for the insights, or maybe like most of life you find a mix?
Yes, I think it's definitely a mix, but I think for the most part people are open. But I do feel like we have the responsibility to do the research to actually show that science and not to say, you know, this is what I believe, so take my word for it. But I think that the other side of that is that I think providers are also very open to trying to help survivors reconnect and have that psychosocial adjustment. I think the challenge becomes, you know, just like in many areas, there's just not enough hours in the day. There's not enough hours in the clinic day in particular. And I don't know. You know, there is a lot of research being done on survivorship clinics and what's the best way to deliver cancer care and what's needed. And I think the challenge is balancing the resources and the costs with what is needed. And I think we have a long way to go before we really figure out the most efficient way to do that. But, I think that the providers are very open and interested in wanting that research to be done and wanting to understand, okay, what does my clinic need to look like in order to meet all of the needs of the patients, not only their disease treatment needs, but their psychosocial needs as well. And I think people only don't do it because they don't know what to do. And so, you know, we have to figure out what works, and then we have to figure out how to integrate that into the clinic. And unfortunately, that's not a quick, simple thing. And that's what I get frustrated with, is how long a process takes to do the research, to figure it out, and then how do you translate that into the clinic where it can be broadly, you know, across all clinics and across the entire country and even world. How do you make this accessible to everybody? So that's the challenge, but there's quite a few people working on that challenge, and I believe that we will get there.
Yeah, and a certain amount of impatience, I'm sure, is a requirement to drive good research and get the results, and then, you know, take those results and put them into action. So on the research front, describe for me, if you would, what is your current research? How is it working? What stage are you at? And what do you hope to gain from it?
So right now, the research that I'm doing with the Breast Cancer Research Foundation is building a 4-component intervention for sexual health. Sexual health is not a very, you know, it's not a simple thing that is caused by one thing. And that's true for all symptoms. Symptoms are complex. They have multiple parts to them. And they're not going to be either prevented or fully treated with just doing one tiny little thing. Sort of like, you know, I don't know, tossing a bucket of water on a fire. You can't, it just doesn't work. You have to have a very strategic, comprehensive approach. So that's what I'm doing with sexual health. The research has shown that there are 4 main predictors of sexual health: partner issues, self-image, desire, which I think in cancer survivors is part of energy, motivation, the fatigue component, and then vaginal symptom issues. And so I'm developing an intervention for each of those components, and then I'm going to put that together into a protocol that can be individualized, because not all women are going to have all of, you know, issues in all those areas. So it can be things that women can sort of say, oh, this is the most important thing to me right now in this area. I want to tackle this, and then maybe then I'll tackle this second thing. So, but a very manualized, easy thing that nurses, social workers in any clinic could help women do pretty much by themselves or with some resources and tools available. So that's what I'm right in the middle of right now.
And what stage are you at in the research?
So it's in different stages for the different components. So the vaginal symptoms, there's been a large study already done and ready to be published. We're submitting that. And so that could actually be already, the information that we learned from that study could already be used in practice. For the self-image study, we're sort of in the middle of fully testing the intervention, and we should be done with that in the next year. The sexual desire energy study is just being written and should be starting within probably the next 6 to 8 months. And then the partner intervention is yet to be developed.
So just quickly, Dr. Barton, I mean, as you have approached research throughout the years, obviously there are a range of organizations, you know, many groups all doing great and terrific work in all areas of cancer. You know, it's not limited, obviously, to just one area. From what does BCRF, how does BCRF work? What does it do in you know, specifically in terms of kind of your approach to research and what you see its approach to research more generally? Anything that makes it you know, different or unique from your point of view?
I think that the Breast Cancer Research Foundation is very unique and facilitatory in terms of research. And I think there's a couple reasons for that. One is they have a group of scientific advisors who really know breast cancer backwards and forwards, and they know what the gaps are, they know what the science is. So you don't have to re-explain that to them. They get it, and they get what's important. And because of that, you can really push the envelope in terms of, I think, innovation and different ways to approach problems get funding to do that. So I always say that the Breast Cancer Research Foundation allows one to do research that is a bit unconventional, things that people wouldn't necessarily in the traditional funding groups either understand or think would work, and yet it does. Because I think sometimes to really move science, we just can't keep doing things the same old way. We really have to think a bit differently and try different approaches. And I think Breast Cancer Research Foundation allows the scientists to do that.
Got it. So there's the completing of the various researches, and then I know you're going to set up protocols for each one of them, or interventions for each one of the four aspects, but I guess somehow bringing them all together, you know, to the extent that it's, you know, reasonable or useful, I guess, in a comprehensive package. I understand you indicated already that not everyone has every symptom, and so, you know, they don't necessarily have to go together. But yeah, that's a wide range and four different aspects. Just to close out, I was interested as well. You're at you work out of the University of Michigan School of Nursing, and the School of Nursing as a platform, or a School of Nursing as a platform for research. You know, it's not what I hear about every every day, which obviously surely only exposes my naivete around this area. So just describe for me the school of nursing as the platform for research and how that informs the type of work that you might do, if it does. This is an area that just kind of struck my curiosity.
Well, the School of Nursing at the University of Michigan, and one of the reasons why I'm there is because there's a very tight connection with the University of Michigan Health System. And as part of that health system is the Cancer Center. So I do my research out of the Cancer Center in collaboration with Cancer Center physicians at the University of Michigan, as well as a lot of my research I do in the large cooperative group system in the United States that is part of the National Cancer Institute. And I don't know how much you have heard about that, but there are different research bases. And so they're funded. So I actually do a lot of research through there. And that's kind of that. It's a great infrastructure to do research through because it is the healthcare delivery part. It's where, it's community cancer centers where most patients are treated. And so if community cancer centers can do the intervention, can implement the study, then they can implement the intervention and integrate that into their care. So it's a great venue to do research when you've got an established intervention that you know is likely to be helpful, and it's how do we then get this to the patient. So I love that. But the initial part of really testing whether this intervention has any promise whatsoever is done through the Cancer Center. But most schools of nursing, well, I shouldn't say most, a lot of schools of nursing will have pockets of faculty who have expertise in a given area. And oncology is a very popular area for nurse scientists. And it's a very popular area for students who are looking for PhDs. We have our new PhD students tell us when they apply, what do you think you want to do your research in? What kind of faculty mentor do you want? And I would say over 50% want oncology, symptom management. So it's a very, I think, attractive area because there is so much to do, and it's so gratifying to really be able to find solutions to some of these issues.
Well, it has to be, and particularly in the areas where you're working that the data show can affect such a high percentage of women who are diagnosed with breast or gynecological cancer, and in most cases for this not to be part of the standard cancer care, just a fascinating opportunity it would seem to me. And it goes back to what you said at the beginning, looking for areas where things are occurring, there are symptoms, but there may be a gap between that and the amount of care that's actively being given. Dr. Deborah Barton is the Mary Lou Willard French Professor of Nursing at the University of Michigan School of Nursing. She's also been a BCRF grantee since 2008. Dr. Barton, thank you so much for your time. I'm Chris Reback. This is BCRF Conversations. To learn more about breast cancer research or to subscribe to our podcast, go to bcrfcure.org/podcast.